Well, it's Wednesday, so this is our fourth evening out of a planned five for this program. I am grateful to the Bayit and Shari Shamayim for partnering with us on this in lieu of our usual fall theme Shabbatonim that we hold in each shul. As well, the Shavuoton is dedicated by the Gutman family and the Litwack family. The Gutmans in memory of Shimon Berglass, Esther's father, and the Litwacks in memory of Alan's parents. So the neshamas should have an aliyah. Tomorrow night, we're going to conclude the Shavuaton with a special program that I am very much looking forward to. Black and Jewish in the Jewish community. Rabbi Sammy Bergman, our Sgan, I think quite a few of you heard him on Monday evening, is going to interview Rabbi Ezra Fraser, Yegidei Omotoso, and Yegidei Omotoso and Yitzhak Ben Kohelet on their experiences and perspectives. So that should be a fascinating program, and I hope you'll be able to make it. The program for this evening, is there room for left-wing politics in a right-wing religion? Came out of a conversation I had with somebody when our Beit Midrash had a Shabbaton at the Bayit in June of 2018. The theme of the Shabbaton was Kibbutz Galuyot, the ingathering of the exiles. And as part of it, we had a session on on non-Jews coming to Israel, and specifically an issue that was very much in the news at the time, the people coming from Sudan, the refugees who were trying to come in and settle in the country. And after the session was over, I was asked, can there be a liberal Jewish state? I actually realized I just forgot to start the recording, so I am going to start the video recording. I hope that will not scare people off of having their screens on, because it's much easier for me to speak when I can actually see people's faces. So I hope that people will still stay visible. Also, since I just let in several people, I'm going to add once again a message in the chat with the link for the source sheet. So again, going back to June 2018, after the session about the African refugees coming to Israel, I was asked, can there be a liberal Jewish state? Can you have a Jewish state that's open to refugees? Can a Jewish state be open to Jews of all stripes of Judaism? Does a Jewish state provide health care for all? Does a Jewish state redistribute wealth? And that actually led to a Shabbaton that we held at the Bayit several months later in October of 2018, as well as a Shabbaton I did at the Or Chaim Minyan in December 2019. I kept revisiting this question as part of those programs. And here I am, still intrigued by the question and trying to discuss aspects of it. But the funny thing is, I looked back at my notes when I created the program for tonight and started out trying to take bits and pieces of it and just sort of restructure it, and ended up basically losing everything that I did on those previous occasions, and this is almost entirely new, because we evolve over time, and the ideas that we have at one stage hopefully evolve and grow, and my thinking has been evolving certainly on this topic. And really the main question is not so much, can there be room for left-wing politics in a right-wing religion, as much as, is there such a thing as an authentic Jewish political identity at all? Now, in order to get anywhere in this conversation, we're going to need to define certain terms. Left-wing and right-wing, liberal, conservative. Note, when I say liberal and conservative, I mean lowercase. I'm not talking about the political parties. I made that mistake with one of the previous programs on this topic. I asked about having a liberal Jewish state, and everybody there thought I was talking about Trudeau. And it took until about 20 minutes in before I understood why people were not following what I was talking about. So it's not what I'm talking about. But let me ask you, can someone give me a concise definition of left-wing, and don't say everybody who is more liberal than I am? That doesn't work. Can you give me a definition of left-wing?
It depends which countries you're in. If you come from a country like I do from Australia, then it's a social democratic party that's left of center. But okay. That's not such a term, certainly not in the States.
Okay. Well, can you give me a description of either the philosophy of someone who is left-wing or particular policies of someone who's left-wing?
Well, I think it's more that the idea that there will be more government, possibly, in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm. Government regulation or intervention in the marketplace. I think that's fair. Moish, you put up your hand. That was very disciplined of you. Yes.
Yes.
It's
very simple. Liberal, the word liberal means one word, change. Left wing means actual change. It's as simple as that. Left wingers are not satisfied with being liberal. I'm both.
Okay. So the idea that left wing is associated with change or liberal is associated with change is definitely something I would like to come back to. Jordan puts in the chat, egalitarian, redistributive, equity, change, utopian, statism. Those are all good words. And yeah, I think a lot of that definitely does fit with what we generally consider left-wing. He also adds plays on the left wing of the hockey team. Thank you. Requisite Canadian joke fulfilled. So that's left-wing. What about right-wing? I'm going to come back to these terms, obviously. But what do people think of when they think of right-wing? I'm not hearing anything. Okay.
Well, I think probably less government involvement in the market than in social programs.
Right. The less government regulation of marketplace, of social programs, I think those are valid, certainly. Okay. Let me take a shot at it. First, a disclaimer. We often say regarding Judaism and regarding Torah, don't judge Judaism by Jews, right? Meaning, the fact that a Jew may misbehave is not necessarily an indication of what the Torah would recommend. The same is true regarding political ideals. We can't judge them based on their messy implementation, which necessarily blurs lines. And I'll give you some examples of what I mean here. And I'm going to use American examples because I frankly understand them more than I understand Canadian politics. I still haven't really adjusted to the whole parliamentary system and a lot that goes with it. But there have been supposedly liberal governments in the U.S. that have adopted conservative policies. Barack Obama bailed out the banks. That's generally considered to be an example of that. On the other hand, there have been supposedly conservative governments in the U.S. that have adopted liberal policies, right? George Bush Sr. famously raised taxes. So you can't really, when you look at implementation, you can't really say that a government is all one way or all another way. I'll give you another example on the source sheet from an article that just appeared the other day in the New York Times. And I'll leave you to decide whether that's right wing or left wing. Leona, you don't have to stick out your tongue when I mention the New York Times. But take a look at source number one. The pandemic is showing us how capitalism is amazing and inadequate. After Pfizer announced highly successful preliminary results for its coronavirus vaccine, Trump administration officials said the good news reflected the success of their Operation Warp Speed program to accelerate vaccine development. Pfizer executives stressed the opposite, noting the company had developed the vaccine with its own resources, not government grants. That was true, but not the whole story. Over the summer, Pfizer had reached a $1.95 billion advance purchase agreement with the United States government, ensuring it will be well compensated for eventually delivering 100 million doses of vaccine. In other words, though the government did not directly fund the drug development, it created the groundwork in which the pharmaceutical company could spend research dollars with abandon, knowing that success will be financially rewarded. So in other words, this is an example of, on the one hand, capitalism, in the sense that it's private sector that came up with the vaccine using their own resources. On the other hand, they're only able to do it because of government intervention. So the writer continues to say, it may seem like a trivial case of a company and an administration each claiming credit for some happy news, but it speaks to a deeper reality the pandemic has revealed. Both what is amazing about capitalism and how the free market alone comes up short in solving enormous problems. And he goes on to say, it's not just in terms of a vaccine. It's more than that. It's in general what he calls COVID capitalism. The success and survival of markets during the pandemic illustrates the need to have government assistance, even as you need private enterprise. So, in terms of implementation, it's hard to say a government is actually all one way, all another way. That's not the way the real world works. When we use these terms, we think more in terms of a pure conception, not necessarily in terms of what's going on in the real world. So, with that in mind, some left-wing liberal ideas of what the state should be. So first of all, people talked about change with left-wing, and I think that's a really, really important point. The ideology that I understand to be a liberal left-wing ideology is that society can progress, the human lot can be improved, and we create government and we empower it to intervene and make those changes. Right? This is, of course, the idea of the term progressive, which is more or less the same thing as saying liberal. There was actually a study done I found out of Georgetown on whether people who call themselves liberal have the same policies as those who call themselves progressive, and they basically said yes. They're the same terms, so I'm going to use them interchangeably. This ideology, when applied to government, creates a government that is, as Karen said before, interventionist domestically and abroad. So it creates a government that says it is our mission to protect people from discrimination based on race, color, sexual identity, religion. It is our job to look after the financial needs of the citizens using regulation if need be, because otherwise property rights might favor some over others. And I brought this for you in source number 2 from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, their liberalism entry. The bold that's there is from me. But I'm not going to read it out because I think it's relatively straightforward. They describe a progression from what they call classical liberalism to a new form of liberalism, which is quite entrenched at this point, which says that government should be involved in the economic life of society and that it's important that government do so. They believe that government's job is to improve the lives of citizens and the state overall, and not to rely on existing institutions, like family, like community, like religion. These institutions are not valid just because they exist. This government will, of course, raise money in order to fund all of these different endeavors, and that money will come from yours truly, right? That's a function of our tax dollars. Government like this is going to be interventionist beyond its borders to promote its values elsewhere as well. Now, one thing that I should note, because someone emailed me about this week, the empowerment of government doesn't mean that the individual has no responsibilities. Liberalism still has a conception of civic duty. There's still a responsibility of the individual. It's not now government's going to take care of everything. But that's my understanding of what we would call left-wing or what we would call liberal. Questions and comments on that before we proceed to detail what right-wing is. Yes, Rabbi Strauchler.
In terms of this, the Venn definition of liberal, what would be the role of mediating institutions between the individual and the state? In other words, would you exclude family, would you exclude community in regards to empowering the state and the individual to operate for their mutual benefit to the exclusion of these other institutions?
So I don't think within liberalism these institutions are simply, you know, cast to the curb. I think insofar as they're able to be useful, the government will make use of them. but they're not the primary address, is my understanding. I thank you for pointing it out, because I think it's an interesting point. The institutions, insofar as they can fill a role that serves the needs of the state, will be used for that purpose. But if they're seen as hamstringing what the government is trying to do, then the liberal, progressive model will say they have to change. It's time for them to keep up with, if you remember Barack Obama saying about those who disagreed with him on an issue, you're on the wrong side of history. That's a progressive idea. Tomorrow everyone's going to disagree with you, basically. That's my understanding. Okay. This is all the left-wing side of it. I see that someone has put a note in the chat arguing about whether the free market is more effective or socialist governments are more effective. We're not there yet. We're not talking about who's effective at this point. We're just talking about what is and what the different sides are. So I'm not, you're ahead of me. The right-wing, conservative conception of what the state should be. So in contrast with the progressive wing, and the approach that says that society can progress, the human lot can be improved, and so forth. The ideology on the right, as I understand it, is you can't rewrite the universe. Human nature is what it is, and we accept the status quo. And I quoted for you on the sheet from Professor Michael Oakeshott, from the London School of Economics, in an essay called Rationalism in Politics, in which he says, this is shorter than source number two, so this one I'll read out loud, to be conservative, then, is to prefer the familiar to the unknown, to prefer the tried to the untried, fact to mystery, the actual to the possible, the limited to the unbounded, the near to the distant, the sufficient to the superabundant, the convenient to the perfect, present laughter to utopian bliss, right? An idea that that you accept things as they are. And what that causes you to do is to construct a government which is less interventionist and less restrictive domestically. Government becomes something that enables rather than something that controls. So it will trust existing institutions to a far greater extent than liberalism to support the needs of society. It will turn to the family, community, religion with this mission. It will trust individuals to engage in commerce in ways that ultimately benefit society rather than intervene and regulate in a way that is, from this perspective, a doomed enterprise. The individual shoulders a much greater burden for himself, for herself, as well as for others as a citizen. I quoted for you in source number four from Jean Kirkpatrick, who of course was Reagan's ambassador to the UN, aside from being before that a university professor, in which she writes, "The conservative brings to reflection about policy, foreign and domestic, an irreducible respect for individual freedom, a suspicion of government that distinguishes him or her from liberals, and an irreducible commitment to citizenship that distinguishes him from libertarians. The conservative understands that the tensions between individualism and patriotism, between self-love and love of country, between realism and idealism, are permanent, that there will always be that kind of tension where on the one hand you want to be idealistic, on the other hand you take the world as it is. So the individual is expected to do more for self and for others, and government will reduce its taxation, expecting that the citizen will pick up where government leaves off. The government will also avoid intervention beyond their borders, other than for self-interest. Now, the empowerment of the citizen doesn't mean there's no duty to government, right? The conservatism still has a conception of government. They're not libertarian, as Jean Kirkpatrick noted there. So, do we have a somewhat clear picture of left and right that we can then work with? If not, because I felt like at this stage we might not, take a look at source number five on the sheet. where I gave you a table, and I just put a link to the sheet again in the chat. As you see, I titled it a helpful question mark table. I hope it's helpful. I hope it's right. In which I looked at the issues that we struggle with and that we, and that societies wrestle with. I picked 9, not as a magic number, but just because I came up with this list first and then the number afterwards. But it happens to be a list of 9 different arenas and what I think could be considered a left-wing point of view versus a right-wing point of view. And once again, as I said, you know, 15 minutes ago, the reality is that governments will not stick to one column. They'll be all left-wing or all right-wing. It's not the way it works. So you'll see governments that identify as being left-wing, but they'll do right-wing things, and vice versa. As noted by Jordan in the chat, there's a spectrum also in both camps, and people are not always consistent. So in our top line, as a great example of that, the role of the government in fighting climate change, the left-wing will say, you bet, absolutely, we're supposed to be making progress. The world can change in a positive way. The right wing will be more suspicious and say, well, we don't like intervention by government. And here I note, as a perfect example, you know, Richard Nixon created the EPA in the United States, the Environmental Protection Agency. So, you know, I actually read one article where someone said that Richard Nixon was left wing of Bill Clinton. That in and of itself is a very interesting line, worthy of discussion. But the idea of redistributing wealth to aid the needy, much stronger as a left-wing idea. The idea of fighting a war against fascist countries that don't threaten you right now, much more of a left-wing idea than a right-wing idea. Taxation to support a government agenda, left-wing says bring it on. Right-wing says no, why would I want to grow government? Freer immigration. Left-wing will say yes, we promote freedom, we promote rights. The right wing will say we have to protect the established community. Freedom of religion. The left wing will be more suspicious because religion may be considered an establishment that will oppose progress. The right wing will say we trust the established institutions. We're good with religion. Free trade. Left wing again will be suspicious because it may want to control trade to help with progressive policies. Right wing will say intervention is limited. You should encourage free trade. Subsidizing public education, both sides will be good with that one. Although, the right wing will say, make sure you enable private education as well. And criminal justice reform, the left wing will be good with it, and the right wing will be good with it, each one for their own reasons. So, there's a lot to be said about all of this, obviously, but I'm gonna pause here for questions and comments. Before we get into the Torah piece of this, because we've basically done, you know, almost 25 minutes on the, just outlining the political philosophy. Mark, I see you have your hand raised.
You raised all these issues. I think that most of my Jewish friends who are right-wing have not read Ayn Rand or John Locke. And the one issue that's most important to them as Americans, from what I know, is abortion on demand. I was curious, why wasn't that on your list?
Right, so I didn't put abortion on the list. I had it in my own list here. I don't remember why I didn't put it on. You could put it on. I think probably because... No, that wouldn't be why. I don't know. I had it on my own list. I'm not sure why I didn't put it there. You could have put it there.
It's much more important for these people than economic issues.
Well, that goes to something... Right, that goes to something that Jordan said in the chat a little while ago, which is... people aren't always consistent, and sometimes people will say, I am with one camp or I am with the other camp based on a single issue and be entirely inconsistent with that philosophy on everything else in their lives. Because often people are not philosophical. You know, people are pragmatic. Yes, Jonathan.
Yeah, I think this list is conflating a couple of things, which is that the way that you're defining liberal and conservatives is really more of a disposition as opposed to kind of a strict boundary. And the table that you put are really policy prescriptions that really more tie in line with kind of American right-wing, classic right-wing, left-wing policy prescriptions as opposed to the disposition. For example, if you could be a conservative who believes in climate change because you believe in the science that backs it, if you believe in that and there's a sense of urgency, and you would still intervene. But dispositionally, you're still a small-c conservative. not be a Republican.
Right. So to a certain extent, I definitely hear what you're saying in terms of the climate change example, but I think to a certain extent, that's more a function of the fact that it is a spectrum and there are things which can push you out of your comfort zone. In other words, a doctrinaire conservative will say, I believe there's such a thing as climate change. I think that industry can take it on. I think individuals can take it on, but I don't want government getting involved. However, a realist will say, I may be a conservative, but I want there to be a planet for my kids. I believe the science, and therefore I'm going to break from my conservatism and say, government, you go do this. In the same way that, you know, to use the U.S. model, Newt Gingrich switched his positions on criminal justice reform. Originally, he was adamant that they should build more prisons. That was his solution to all problems. And he changed his mind when he realized that you were just creating a larger and larger government infrastructure and you weren't solving any problems. If anything, you're making them worse. So, you know, people stick with their doctrines until their doctrines fail so spectacularly that they say, you know, on this one, I need to make an exception. That's my understanding of it. I'm not a political philosopher. I'm a computer science major. I just read, and I could read things wrong. That happens. But I think that what you're pointing out is certainly true. I just don't think it contradicts this. I think it's just that people are not as doctrinaire in reality as they are, you know, in philosophy. And I think that's part of it. And the other piece of it that you mentioned in terms of American examples, it's absolutely true that the left-wing, right-wing side will have different policies depending on what your society is like. And this was Karen's point before about Australia. The reality is that left-wing in one country may qualify as right-wing in another. It's much more the issue of the ideology than where you come down in a particular issue. That's the way I would look at it. So, other questions or comments before we see what all this has to do with Torah? Okay, then let's get moving. So, I would make the argument that you could see Judaism as indeed right-wing. You could argue that Judaism is inherently conservative, small c. It's very trusting of the institutions and the past. It is a religion built on Masorah, right? Built on tradition. Moshe kibel Torah mi Sinai. Moshe received the Torah at Sinai, and he conveyed it, and he conveyed it, and he conveyed it. Eventually, a she conveyed it in our generation. Rav Hai Gaon, writing in the 10th century, says that the definition of Jewish practice is what have Jews done all along. That's how you want to know what a Jew does. You want to know what a mitzvah is. Don't just go to the text. He says, ask your grandparents, what do Jews do? And there is a stout respect for what those earlier generations did. I brought just one example. This is always a fun source. Source number 6 on the source sheet. And the line in the Gemara, Im Rishonim b'nei Malachim anu b'nei Anashim. If the early generations were like the sons of angels, we are like human beings. V'im Rishonim b'nei Anashim, and if they were human beings, anu kacham orim, we are donkeys. And by the way, not like the donkey of Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa, Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair, which were special donkeys, which were credited with not supernatural, but super donkey traits. They, not like that, we'd be like regular donkeys. The statement that we can't live up to those who came before us, that which they have established is beyond us. The concept of niskatnu hadoros, that generations have actually shrunk over time, is fundamental within Judaism, as is a trust for institutions to take care of society, institutions like the family, institutions like the community, as we're going to discuss. Because of that philosophy, you can argue Judaism has a vision of government which would qualify as right-wing. On the practical administrative level, if you start in the Chumash, and you work your way to the Talmud, and you work your way to the Rambam. Government is non-interventionist in Judaism. What's the job of a king in Judaism? What does a king do all day?
Fight.
Sorry?
Fight.
Fight. Right. Kings go to war. The Rambam has a section in his Mishneh Torah, the Laws of Kings, as it's called in English. In Hebrew, people usually call it Hilchot Melachim, but that's not actually the title of the section. The title is Hilchot Melachim U'Milchamotehem, the Laws of Kings and their Wars. The king is almost synonymous with war. If you take a look at source number 7, I brought you the passage in the Torah which describes the institution of the monarchy. It's from Parshas Shoftim. I'm just going to read the English translation aloud in the interest of time. If after you have entered the land that the Lord your God has assigned to you and taken possession of it and settled in it, you decide, I will set a king over me, as do all the nations about me, you shall be free to set a king over yourself, one chosen by the Lord your God. By the way, as I noted on the sheet, this is the JPS 1985 translation. I was a little rushed to do my own. All the other ones are my translations. So, you shall be free to set a king over yourself. Be sure to set as king over yourself one of your own people. You must not set a foreigner over yourself. This is a discussion about fear of a Manchurian candidate. The one who is not your kinsman. Moreover, he shall not keep many horses or send people back to Egypt to add to his horses, since the Lord has warned you, you must not go back that way again, ... When he is seated on his royal throne, he shall have a copy of this teaching written for him on a scroll by the Levitical priests. Let it remain with him, and let him read it all his life, so that he may learn to revere the Lord his God, to observe faithfully every word of this teaching, as well as these laws, and so on. Interesting. I'm actually looking at this JPS translation and not liking it very much, but not for reasons that'll keep us from dealing with this right now. Within this context, do I learn anything about what a king does?
What about writing a Torah?
Well, that was that last bit, the part about having the Torah there. Yes. He has to have a Torah with, and he actually has two. He has to have two Torahs. Normal people have one, he has to have two. But what does he do? He reads from the Torah. That I know. He has restrictions on his ambitions when it comes to wealth, when it comes to horses, when it comes to gold and silver, when it comes to marriages. He has limitations there. But I don't know what a king does. But that's okay, because the Rambam is going to tell me. Flip to source number 8, please. The Rambam writes in that Laws of Kings and Their Wars, he says, here's what a king is supposed to be. He says, the king has to be really humble and concerned for the citizens. Just as the Torah assigned great honor to the king and all are obligated to honor him, so the Torah instructed him to keep his heart humble and low within himself, and he quotes you David HaMelech, King David, to that effect. He may not act with undue arrogance towards the nation. He must be generous and merciful for small and great, exit and enter at their desire and for their good. He's got to do the supermarket openings. They must care for the honor of the smallest of the small. When he speaks to the community at large, he must speak gently. He must always act with a surfeit of humility. But what does he do? Is the Rambam telling me what a king does? Whatever he does, he's doing it humbly. But what is he doing? I don't know. He goes in and out when they tell him to. Doing what? Robbie?
Wasn't the original purpose that a king was to unite all the different little mini-tribes so they would have a united army? Isn't that originally why the people wanted a king?
So why they wanted a king is something that I definitely want to revisit shortly. There's definitely a unifying element to the monarch. There is definitely a military aspect to the monarch. Take a look at source number 9. Source number 9 will give us some sense of it. The Rambam gives us the criteria for Mashiach. How do you know that somebody is the Messiah? And he writes, if a king were to arise from the house of David, speaking Torah and involved in mitzvot like his ancestor David, following the written and spoken Torah, and he would compel all Israel to follow it and strengthen it, he would fight the wars of God, he would be presumed to be Mashiach. So he has to get everybody to follow the Torah, and he has to fight the wars of God. That is the job description for a king, as far as the Rambam is concerned. That's what he does. This is not a king who is regulating the market, right? This is not a king who is arranging health care. He's just not. The king's job is to go to war and to be humble about it when he interacts with the nation and to follow the Torah and get other people to follow the Torah. So who's minding the store? Like, there's nothing else going on in the government. Who is actually running the show? Oh, that's no problem. We have rabbis for that. Take a look at source number 10. The Rambam in Hilchot Sanhedrin, the beginning of the laws of courts. There is a biblical command to appoint judges and officers in every land and area. And he quotes you the verse, Shoftim v'shoftim titein lecha. Shoftim are the judges who are fixed in court with litigants coming before them. Shotrim are the wielders of the staff and lash. They stand before the judges and they circulate in the markets and streets and stores to fix the prices and measures and to strike all who are corrupt. All of their deeds are at the word of the judges. And when they see impropriety in a person, they bring him to court and judge him according to his wickedness. So their job is to enforce the Torah. That's what they do. Sorry? No, not Kohanim here. The Kohanim teach. We find that a bit in Tanakh. But these are the Shotrim. These are officers, police officers, if you will. So what you're seeing here is that government is of a very limited role, as far as I can tell. The king is not really involved. The courts are doing more in terms of getting people to do what they're supposed to do, the courts and their officers, but still not overseeing government policies, running, regulating society. That's just not there. We have a principle in the Torah, mentioned in the Talmud in Bava Kamma, called Dina Demachuta Dina. The law of the land is the law. Why is the law of the land the law? Rabbeinu Nisim in source number 11 says, you know why? Because they own the land, therefore what they say goes. The government owns the land, therefore we have to follow their rules. It's not about benefit for society. It's not we honor their rules because that will help society. It's their football. That's it. It's a very laissez-faire type of approach. Society is going to run, and as long as people follow the Torah, and as long as the king can go to war, we're fine. I brought you a piece in source number 12, but it needs its own real examination, so I'm not going to go through it right now. Rabbi Usher Weiss talks about this kind of economic approach in which he says, basically, that for all the protections that Jewish law provides from limiting competition in business, nonetheless, he says, at the end of the day, we're pretty laissez-faire about what people do in business. Now, Jordan notes something in the chat. We have also not had a lot of historical experience in running a state to develop public administration skills and philosophies as evidenced by Medinat Yisrael today. That's for sure a fair point. That's why you talk about what it says in Tanakh, you talk about what it says in the Gemara, you talk about what it says in the Rambam, and then you kind of stop. Because for a very long time after the Rambam, you don't have rabbis writing practical guidance at all on this area. It isn't really until you hit the 20th century that you see a flourishing of literature in this regard. So that's certainly true. But what I'm suggesting here so far is that you're seeing a minimalist approach to government, and you're seeing a trust in tradition and traditional institutions. Not only that, but some of the values embraced by what are usually called right-wing political parties, certainly in the U.S., tend to fit with a certain picture of what Judaism believes. So abortion was mentioned before as an example of that, that Judaism would be right to life. Now, the truth of the matter is you have to be really, really careful about that statement, because you can make the argument that Judaism would prefer to actually be pro-choice, in the sense that there are cases in which a right-to-lifer would not allow the abortion, and Jewish law would say you have to do it. So don't be so quick to assume how we align on abortion. Maybe that's why I took it out of the box earlier. But Yeah, there are certain things which, certain policies which sound like they're policies which right-wing aligns with traditional Judaism. So another example of that, big fight in the United States for many years, the issue of having the Pledge of Allegiance recited in schools. That Judaism would be a big fan of having the Pledge of Allegiance under God recited in schools. And that's considered to be a right-wing idea. You can support this, and there's more we could say, but it's already 8:44. And I want to show you the other side. Paul has already jumped the gun on me in the chat. But Jordan, yes, in terms of what you say there, would it be fair to say that halacha relies more on knowledge and personal self-discipline, therefore less need for a police state? If I stopped here, yeah, I think you could say that. But I'm not stopping here. We have more to see. Someone was trying to comment? Nope. Okay. So, you could also think of Judaism as left-wing. In ideology, Judaism is absolutely confident that there will be progress. And we are to create that progress ourselves. Judaism is fundamentally an optimistic religion. I quote you from Menachem Begin. In source number 13, in 1951, Menachem Begin published a platform. It was really published. He made it a speech. It was a very long speech, like hours. But it was the Chayrut platform that he issued in 1951. It's beautiful. You can find it online. It's called Basic Outlines of Our Life, Worldview, and National Outlook. And in this, listen to what I have here in number 13. Israel's prophets and seers from whom we have inherited the aspiration for justice that guide our repose, elevated visions that are very difficult to realize. There were those that introduced the vision of social justice to repair the world and the kingdom of God, and those that highlighted the vision of world government and everyone will make one association. That gave mankind the vision of world peace, and nation will not raise sword against nation. However, they did not delude their generation or the coming generations. They admitted that the realization will be difficult and saw it only at the end of days. They made their vision a sort of guiding star by whose light man wandering in darkness will proceed and find his path and even reach his objective. They didn't fool you. What happens is Begin in this is, on the one hand, trying to give a speech which lays out certain ideas for change and certain ideas for progress, but he doesn't want to go too far because he's also arguing against Ben-Gurion at the same time. And he doesn't believe in Ben-Gurion's brand of socialism. And that also comes through in this. And there's a lot more. Read his essay. It's really fantastic. But the point that I quote this for is not just to get a gratuitous quote of Menachem Begin in, although that's always worthwhile. But because he points you to the Nevi'im. He points you to the prophets and their vision of repairing the world and the kingdom of God. Everyone gathering as one. You consider the visions in the 11th chapter of Yeshaya. It's very consistent with that. Rabbi Strauchel, you were going to say?
I wanted just to raise a point in regards to not just the teleology of Judaism towards Gula, but also in terms of the role of halacha in relationship to the Melech, and that the halacha itself is interventionist, and halacha itself integrates the Melech as the Melech integrates halacha as well.
You're two steps ahead of me, so you hang in there. You're right. I'm not there yet. Within this concept of progress, I wanted to show you what Rav Aaron Lichtenstein said when describing the Zionism of Rav Soloveitchik, because this isn't what Rabbi Strauchler was saying, I think, although maybe it fits with what you were saying as well, but as Rav Aaron read it, Rav Soloveitchik's Zionism was a halachic Zionism. He looked at Zionism as an expression of what halacha expects the human being, the Jew, to engage in. He's in source number 14. He brings you an excerpt from the eulogy that Rav Soloveitchik gave for his uncle, Rav Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, the Griz, who was anti-Zionist. And in this excerpt here, he quotes his uncle's ideology and contrasts it with some who say. So take a look at what he says, just the italicized part of source 14. Indeed, there are some who say that the halakha, which is all-inclusive and all-encompassing and all-penetrating, which is concerned with every detail of existence, does not remove itself from the concrete event, and even rebels against it. Halakha is courageous and full of strength. It knows nothing of disappointment, nor does it accept the mastery of the event. It storms it time and again, and will not cease until it succeeds in establishing the superiority of divine ideal over it. In other words, what he's saying is, halakha demands that we act, halakha demands that we make change, and we do not accept the world as it is. There is room to neither tremble nor despair. And there's a great quote in the same article, which I brought you in number 15. Look at this. The Rav had no patience for philosophies that glorified passivity and reliance on miracles. At the beginning of the 1960s, a few years after the launch of Sputnik, I had occasion to talk with the Rav about those people who claim that man should not reach for the heavens, for, quote, the heavens are the heavens of God, and only the earth is given to human beings. The Rav heaped scorn upon them. One of those present jumped up to protest. But Rabbi, the Ramban in Bechukosai speaks about how a person should have faith in the Holy One and not to delve into matters that are too wondrous for him. And the Rav replied, I heard from my father in the name of my grandfather that the Ramban never uttered that statement. He said, nonsense. He was an activist. And as Rav Kook said in source number 16, because if it's worthwhile to bring a gratuitous quote from Menachem Begin, it is also important to bring a gratuitous quote from Rav Kook, the world is guaranteed to come to complete repentance. The world does not remain in one place. It perpetually evolves. The idea of growth and of change is very much a part of the Torah's philosophy, and it's halachic philosophy. Now let's turn our attention to the role of government. It may be true that monarchy is non-interventionist, but the rabbinate and local government are highly interventionist. Let's talk about regulating commerce. There's a concept in the Talmud called Kofin al Midat Sodom. We compel people not to act like Sodom, which means if I am in a business arrangement with somebody else, and I could help the other guy and it wouldn't cost me anything, I am obligated to help the other guy. I'm not allowed to take advantage of the opportunity for myself. This is an example of regulating commerce, in this case, in order to aid the other party. A better example of regulation may be the enactments that the sages made in order to encourage lending. Lending is considered to be of principal importance in Judaism. If you remember the crisis when there were no loans, right, a while back, you know how important lending is. Lending is the principal form of tzedakah in Judaism. And the rabbis bent over backwards to try to find ways to encourage lending, and they made regulations to support that. So, for example, the rule is that in order to litigate financial cases, you have to have expert judges. But there's a problem, because it's hard to get expert judges. And if I have an opportunity to lend somebody money, but I know that if I ever have to go to court over it, I'm going to need to get expert judges. I'm going to say, forget it. I don't want to lend him the money. And so the sages said, it's in source number 17, it's a Gemara in Sanhedrin, you know what? We're going to forgive that requirement. You don't need expert judges in order to handle a financial case, because we want to make sure that people will actually lend money to others. Shelo tinol delas bifnei lovin. An example of rabbinic intervention in order to regulate. Another example of it, this is another favorite example, the Magen Avraham, and this was actually done by the Tzemach Tzedek, not the second Lubavitcher Rebbe, the other Tzemach Tzedek in Moravia. If the vendors are elevating the price of fish for Shabbos, it will be good to make a takana, to make a rule that people should not have fish for Shabbos. We will ban gefilte fish in order to drive down the prices. Whenever I quote this, somebody says, "Well, why don't the rabbis do that about Pesach food?" But the point that I'm bringing here is to show you rabbis getting involved in exactly this kind of regulation. We find an emphasis, of course, on tzedakah, but even more than tzedakah. I brought you a Rashi in source number 20. This is confounding if you want to fancy Judaism right wing. It's the story of the Egla Arufa. The Egla Arufa is a ritual in which the people in a town find a body outside of the town. Somebody was murdered. They don't know who killed the person. And they have to perform a whole ritual, which we're not going to discuss right now, except to say that as part of the ritual, the sages of the town have to go outside the city and make a declaration. Our hands did not spill this blood, and our eyes did not see. And the Talmud asks the question, what in the world does that mean? Who would have thought that the sages were the ones who killed this guy? To which they explain, the Talmud says, it's Gemara in Sota, we didn't see him and send him away without an escort. Now, the traditional way to read that line is to say the following. This guy who got killed outside of town was probably somebody who was just traveling alone, and because no one was with him, he was attacked by a bandit and he was killed. But that's not the way Rashi reads it. Look at Rashi in source number 20. Meaning our hands did not spill it, he was not killed due to us, that we sent him away without food and he needed to attack people and was thereby killed. Meaning, the sages would be responsible if they sent somebody away or let him go on his own and he became a criminal and died because of his criminal behavior. You follow? Rashi is saying that society holds that responsibility, for not helping him in a way that such a he shouldn't need to turn to a life of crime. I'll give you another example on a very different arena: healthcare. Take a look, please, at source number 21. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg writing just a couple of decades ago in Israel about the duty for society to fund the healthcare of others. It was so obvious, he writes, to halachic authorities that there is such a duty to pay for an ill person's treatment upon all of those around the ill person, to the point that they debated the case in which the community had spent without asking the ill person, is he obligated to repay them or not? Because they were obligated to pay for it. Based on what has been said, it is clear and simple that the government, which must have the health of society as its top concern, must also allocate funds to help prevent the development of this disease of nearsightedness. He was talking about an issue of yeshiva students who had vision issues. By providing the necessary treatment via expert doctors, he says, there is a responsibility to look after them. I'm going to go back a step. We talked about Dina de Malchuta Dina, the law of the land is the law. And I mentioned to you that the view of Rabbeinu Nissim is the law of the land is the law because government owns the land. Not everybody agrees with that idea, that's why. Source number 22, Rabbi Moshe Isserlist, the Ramah, says that's not necessarily what it's about. He says we recognize as law not only that which benefits the monarch, but also that which benefits the citizens. It's not about, well, the government owns the land, so whatever benefits the government automatically is it. It's society. It's not about government per se. We recognize laws that benefit society as a whole. So Jordan had said something important in the chat. He said, it seems like these types of interventions are episodic rather than constant, and still rely on personal action. So I would agree with the second half, but not the first. They're only episodic because I'm trying to cram a lot into an hour, and so I'm picking here and picking there and picking there and, you know, giving you examples of commerce and redistribution of wealth and healthcare and Dina de Malchusa. To do it systematically is a week-long seminar in its own right. A worthwhile thing to do probably. But in terms of relying on personal action, I think that's true. But the point that I'm trying to make is that halacha imposes upon the rabbinate a responsibility of regulation, which sounds very progressive to me. And when we look at particular policies that are associated with the left wing, we tend to see many of them in Judaism as well. The idea of accepting open immigration, while much more complicated than we're going to do as a soundbite right now, has strong precedent in Judaism. Va'ahav temes hager, you have to love the stranger. Mishpat echad yalachem lager l'ezrach haaretz, you shall have one law for everybody, whether it's a citizen or whether it's a stranger. Los Askir Eved al Adonav. If a slave runs away and lands up in your land, you're not allowed to return him to his master. Yeah, the yes, it's complicated in implementation, but don't kid yourself. There's a very strong imperative in Judaism for that. You can make the argument for climate change as well. So that what I come to here, out of what we've said so far, is you can make the argument for Judaism as right-wing, both in terms of ideology and in terms of its view of government. Conservative, trusting the past, honoring the past, even being in awe of the past, absolutely. The king, not busy with regulating things. That's just not his role, it's not what he does. And by the way, there's a whole other parsha here. I keep saying king, as though king is necessarily the ideal form of government within Judaism. There's a whole other topic of, do we prefer king or do we prefer a democratic system, which is really a topic for, you know, in its own right. But I think you can also make the argument that Judaism is left-wing, that it's progressive, that it believes in progress. And the onus is on us, not on the monarch, but on the rabbinate and on the local town councils to actually become interventionist and to make change and the types of changes that we associate with a more left-wing approach. So to me, a Jewish political identity is neither left nor right, but a hybrid. We believe in progress like the left wing, but we believe in tradition and conserving institutions like the right wing. We may have a monarchy that's not interventionist, but local government and the rabbinate are decidedly interventionist. And specific policies may be seen as left or right. The bottom line is, when in doubt, you look to the Torah for guidance. That's not a surprise. Sof davar hakol nishma. But just as the king is supposed to carry a Torah and listen to the Navi, I'll point you to something that's very interesting to me. Source number 23. On the sheets from the Ran. In the 8th chapter of the book of Shmuel, the Jews come to Shmuel and say, yes, we know you're the prophet right now and you're the shofet right now, but we want to have a king. And Shmuel is very angry. And he turns to God and says, what am I going to do with these people? And God's response is, don't worry, it's not you, it's me. They're not rejecting you. They're rejecting me. And all the commentators read that and say, but what are you talking about? We saw Devarim chapter 17, in which it says, when you come into the land, you're going to say, let's have a king. And here are the rules. If you don't want them to have a king, why did you give them rules for having a king? Well, what were you thinking? So there are all sorts of different approaches, but I want to highlight for you Rabbeinu Nisim in source number 23. In his Drashot Haran, he gives you a lot of political theory. It's fascinating. So just my translation here in 23. He says, here's what was going on in Shmuel when they asked for a king. They wanted basic justice between parties to come from the throne. As in what you see there in Shmuel Aleph, where when the people said, we want a king who's going to govern us and like all the nations, which I take to mean that they thought that national order would function best when it flowed from the throne, as opposed to from the shofet. The shofet answers to God. We don't want that. We want a human being who's going to be in charge. Therefore, they said to Shmuel, you have aged and you can no longer judge. Your children are not suited to cause divine benefit to be manifest upon us. They don't follow your ways. It will be appropriate for us to have a king and for our judgment to happen through him. And thus they said, place a king upon us to judge us like all the nations. Had they asked for a king in general, saying, place a king upon us. Had they asked for the sake of battle, there would have been neither guilt nor sin in this. That would have been fine. It would have been a mitzvah. Their sin was in saying, place a king upon us to judge us like all the nations, wanting their judgment to flow from the throne, not from judges of Torah. And you see it in the text when they said, place a king upon us alone. And therefore God, in which did not say, as they said, place a king upon us alone. You need more context to follow that line. But, and therefore God said to Shmuel, they did not reject you. They rejected me from reigning over them. They chose natural running of their affairs as opposed to divine control. In other words, what the Ran is saying is the mistake becomes when we say, I want to run it this way. I want to run it my way. I want a human being to make the call. You need the Navi, the prophet. You need the Shofet. You need the judge who is working with messages from God. And in the event that you don't have that, then you look back to the Halacha. And you look back to the Torah. But not to be doctrinaire left wing or right wing, because it doesn't really fit. There are elements of both that are found within Torah. The biggest danger, and this goes back to Jordan's comment again in the chat, the biggest danger is that we cherry pick. That we say, I believe in a right-wing approach. The following sources support me. Torah is right-wing. I believe in a left-wing approach. The following sources support me. Therefore, Torah is left-wing. It's more complicated than that. The ideology to support both sides is found in Torah. The specific policies to support both sides are found in Torah. I don't think that it is a right-wing religion. I don't think it is a left-wing religion. I think it's a complicated religion. To me, that's the answer. At least, you know, I said in the beginning, this is now the third time I've addressed this topic, and each time I've done it in a different way. But where I am right now is that it's a lot more complicated than left or right. Now, we generally try to hold these to an hour, so if anybody needs to go, that's fine, but I'll stick around. If anyone wants to stay on the Zoom and make comments or ask questions. Thank you very, very much. And again, as I said in the beginning, Rabbi Sammy Bergman is speaking tomorrow evening. He is interviewing Rabbi Ezra Fraser, Yejide Omotoso, and Yitzhak Ben Kohelet on Black and Jewish in the Jewish community. So that's in this Zoom at this address at 8 o'clock tomorrow night. Thank you very, very much. Okay, Mark, you have a hand up.